Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
And good evening, Laguna Beach, and welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist, and this is a show that explores our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Monday evening at 8 p.m. So tonight we have a very exciting topic, which I think this issue is constantly in the news. It's about getting enough sleep, and specifically around is my child getting enough sleep? Do they have a sleep disorder? What does that even mean? What does a sleep disorder even look like in a child? Because if you have kids, you know that getting your baby to sleep, it's a gift from the gods. If you somehow received a child who from arrival just slept through the night. I have four children, and I will say none of them were great sleepers, though the first two were probably the worst. So I'm welcoming my guest, Dr. Gary Feldman. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Kim.
Welcome. Thanks for joining me. Dr. Feldman is the founder of the Ocean Sleep Medicine
Center.
Mm-hmm. And he has quite an extensive history in terms of understanding sleep, pediatric sleep and behavioral medicine issues in Southern California. He's received numerous awards and is a very sought-after speaker who talks about a variety of topics, including behavioral and neurodevelopmental disorders, pediatric sleep disorders, and international adoption medicine. Did I get all of that?
Yep.
Do you want to add anything to that one?
That's good enough.
All right. So we are just going to go through what sleep looks like in terms of age for children, and hopefully maybe touch on some adult topics if we get a chance at the end. But I'm pretty sure we'll probably spend the majority going through this one. Because I think that obviously, I guess my question is, you know, if you're not sleeping well as a child, given the extensive nature of sleep issues as adults, it seems like that sets you up to potentially have a greater risk of having a sleep issue as an adult.
Absolutely. You know, Kim, about 30% of children who have untreated sleep problems will evolve into adults with sleep issues, which are chronic. Right. So it's really helpful to identify the sleep issues, not only for a parent, for their own sense of well-being and getting their own sleep, but also for the child's well-being for their future.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm glad you're here to talk about it, because I think so many parents don't really know what the difference is between, you know, is this a phase and then it becomes this chronic thing and then they just sort of avoid dealing with it. So let's talk about, before we go into the age groups and sort of what those issues are, what are the things that you will see, behaviors and, you know, emotional responses to lack of sleep or sleep issues?
Yeah, that's a great question, because sleep affects our lives really, and without sleep we can't function. And particularly for children, children manifest the difficulties that they have with sleep. The manifestations in the day are much more significant and much more widespread in comparison with adults. So children who lack sleep may have more mood issues, more irritability. They may have learning problems. They're much more predisposed to having attention deficit type issues, difficulties with self-regulation, difficulties with executive functioning. So it's really, and if you think about a child who's spending most of the day at school, if they're not sleeping well, it's really going to affect their academic performance and also affect their social performance.
Right, definitely. Yeah, it makes me moody when I don't sleep. Okay, I get cranky, speaking of moody. Is there a relationship between, like, if I have a history of having sleep issues, that my child is more likely to have sleep issues, or is that not a thing?
The answer is yes and no. So that's an ambiguous answer, because there are some inheritable sleep conditions, but they're very few, and it's a very low percentage. The majority of sleep is actually in children. Sleep issues is actually learned.
Okay.
It may be comorbid. For instance, if you have children with special needs, for example, children with autism, about 70 to 80% of those children have sleep problems. Mm-hmm. So there may be some genetic influence, but generally speaking, for children, most of the sleep problems are actually acquired.
Okay, so it's our fault. I'm just kidding.
Maybe.
Maybe a little bit.
Maybe not.
I do. I think with your firstborn especially, you're just hovering over them, mm-hmm. right? Are they breathing? And that becomes this, you know, it can become, I guess, foster a sense of fear and worry, mm-hmm. and then hovering and then managing and all that becomes a whole other thing, right? They can't sleep. Mm-hmm. And then you don't sleep, right? So I think the idea is true. We're not really being
It just compounds. The situation just compounds.
Exactly.
And then you end up in coping mode.
Right.
Rather than being, you know, responsive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Coping / coffee mode,
yeah.
Which is probably not a good strategy either. Okay. So before we go into the actual age groups as well, can you walk me through sort of the number of the sort of the sleep issues that you treat, that you look at, or the hallmarks of what are we looking for in general?
Well, I think in my field, because I not only do pediatric sleep medicine, but I also do developmental behavioral pediatrics, so I'm seeing a lot of kids with behavioral problems, learning problems, special needs. And part of the workup is always to look at sleep because it plays such a vital role in how they function.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that about 50% of children do have some form of sleep problem. So it's important, even in it doesn't matter what we do, whether we doing clinical psychology, whether we're doing just primary medicine, it's really important. Whether we're an educator, it's important to look at sleep because it's playing such a vital role in the function of the child.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's just go right into it. So obviously, we have a newborn, and we come home with this beautiful, perfect little baby. What are the issues you see in infants and toddlers?
So. You know, in a newborn baby, one can expect, I mean, a newborn baby may only nap for a few hours at a time. So they essentially, in their 24-hour day, they're napping, they're awake for a short time, they get a feed, they go back to sleep. So it's pretty irregular. And up to the first 6 months of life, babies, in terms of their sleep stages, they spend 50% of their sleep in what we call a slow wave sleep or deep sleep, and then the other 50% in active sleep or what was known as REM or REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a process during the first 6 months of really the baby kind of sorting out their sleep pattern. It's interesting how nature comes together because around about 6 months of age, babies start to have consolidated sleep. That's when they start to join up these little fragments,
mm-hmm.
and they tend to have, well, they should start to have more longer periods of undisturbed sleep. And that coincides with when babies don't need to feed,
mm-hmm.
where they can have a feed, at their bedtime and then maybe last 5, 6 hours, 7 hours, and then have another feed.
Mm-hmm.
And so often that's where things can go wrong, because if you have, as you say, a first-time parent, a first-time mother who's, say, nursing their baby, and the baby cries or wakes up for a zillion billion reasons, your first thing is, oh, my baby's hungry, I must feed the baby. And so one can often get into a mindset of where you end up wanting to care for your baby, but in a sense, you're caring, but you may also inadvertently be disturbing them because mm-hmm. one is not aware of the fact that, gee, they really don't need a feed. You started them on solid foods, and that's a good reason, so that they can last and they can run the distance for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lack of understanding of the normal physiology, at least in the first 6 months of life, can really have a negative impact on how one intervenes or what one should or should not do mm-hmm. when your baby is sleeping.
So how do you help, new mothers with that? What would be the way you would approach that?
I think, I really think that it's important for new mothers to say, you have instinct. And you forget about everything you're reading on the internet or reading in books. Sure, you should educate yourself, but you also have an instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a new mother, and of course, I'm a male, I've never been a mother, but I have two children, and having lived with them and growing up and seeing them grow up, as a parent, even as a father, you're hovering and you're wanting to make sure, especially if it's your first child, that you're doing the right thing. I don't want to break this child, and especially if it's a vulnerable child, like a baby born premature or a newborn baby that's had some medical illness or some chronic issue. It's quite understandable that as a parent, you're going to be very anxious and you're going to be wanting to do the right thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to sort of stop and just stop for a moment and zoom out and say, okay, my baby's safe. Where's my baby right now physiologically? And really, what is my instinct telling me, rather than what so-and-so said, my neighbor said, what did I read on the internet, what did I read in this magazine? Just stop for a moment and look at your child and say, is my baby healthy or is my baby well? If so, okay, then I can breathe a little bit and let's just see how things play out. And allow your baby to give you the signals and not necessarily preempt.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I'm trying to say, is don't preempt, rather wait and see and then respond.
That makes sense. Okay. Yes, over the course of this many years, there have been many different theories and techniques about how to get your baby to sleep.
Right.
So what are your thoughts about the cry it out, all these different methods that come up? What's mm-hmm. been your experience with those, and what has been most effective in your perspective?
Yeah, it's interesting because in babies, let's take the ages from 0 to 2, probably the most common sleep issue in about a third of babies is what we call behavioral insomnia of childhood. And those come in three types. The one is sleep onset association type, then you have the limit setting type, and then if you put both together, you have combined type. So I like to call it chocolate, vanilla, and Rocky River.
Okay. So go through those again slowly. Chad, let's go through those again.
So let's go through the first one. Okay. So it's behavioral insomnia of childhood sleep onset association type.
Okay, that's
And
a
so
lot.
It's helpful. Well, let's break it down. It's helpful to understand what is the mechanism, what is actually going on mechanically, if you like, with babies and why do they do this. So there's two important principles to understand. And this applies to all of us, adults as well, when we go to sleep. We all have a behavior that we associate with falling asleep. Mm-hmm. So that behavior might be, you might have a favorite sleeping position. When I go to sleep and I turn the lights out and I'm going to go to bed now, I'm going to sleep, I like to roll on my left side and curl up into a fetal position. Mm-hmm. That's what I associate with, I'm going to sleep now. Mm-hmm. Some people, I have a friend who has to watch TV and has to fall asleep while watching TV. Some people have to read. So there's a behavior that we associate with falling asleep. And babies and young children are no different. So if they can learn to fall asleep themselves, in a sense, where their sleep onset association is, if you like, self-imposed, it's something that they do, that they have control over, then they don't need any external help.
Okay.
So let's just stop there. That's the first concept, the behavior that we associate with falling asleep. The other important point to understand is that we are all programmed to wake up at night spontaneously. It's just how we are programmed, sometimes three times a night, sometimes up to five or more. So when we wake up naturally, and how do we put ourselves back to sleep? We reemploy that behavior that we associated with falling asleep at bedtime. We reemploy that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if a baby is able to fall asleep independently without needing outside help, then when they wake up naturally at night, they just say,
go back to sleep.
Whatever, I'm going to sleep now. And they put their thumb in their mouth or whatever they do, and they go to sleep. So what happens? Let's take a case scenario. So little Johnny gets an ear infection and is very miserable, understandably, et cetera, et cetera. And so mom or dad are holding him and rocking him and comforting him because he's in pain. And so we get through that, and eventually the ear infection goes, the pain subsides. But little Johnny, during the few days that he's been comforted during the night, has said, this is pretty cool. I like this rocking, right? Or I like being nursed. And so what happens is, in a sense, a new sleep onset association behavior has been induced.
Okay.
So now the child begins to say, well, hey, this is a new paradigm, and I rather like this. This is much more fun than me having to put myself to sleep. And so they become dependent on an outside source to help them fall asleep. And then what happens is, so let's take a case scenario, and I can give you zillions of examples, but one example of a child who needed to be nursed, rocked, then put in a stroller, which was pushed over thick rugs on the floor so that the stroller would vibrate.
Wow.
Sound machine, music, needing all those different factors in order to be able to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of those, can you imagine a child who's being rocked and bounced? Well, that may or may not be soothing. After a while, it may actually be like, I don't particularly like this, but as a parent, we've got ourselves in such a pattern that it almost can prolong the process.
Wow, yeah.
And then what happens is that, you know, the child eventually falls asleep, which is great. And then parents have to be very sure before they leave, if they're holding the child or when they're going to put the baby down in the crib, that they better be sure that this baby is completely asleep, because if the baby wakes up in the process of putting them in the crib, they're going to say, what's going on here? Where are you going?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll cry. And then what will happen is the parent will have to go back, and it ends up reinforcing the same behavior.
Right.
Then when the baby wakes up in the middle of the night, naturally, they wake up, there's no parent. I was being rocked. I was being nursed to sleep. What's going on here? So they'll signal for attention, mm-hmm. cry. Then they're going to make a big noise. The other children in the house are going to be disturbed. The other parents got to go to work at 4 o'clock in the morning. We just got to get this child to keep quiet. So we rush over. We do what we did at bedtime to keep the child asleep. So we end up reinforcing the very behavior
right. That
we are struggling with.
Okay. So, I mean, it seems like starting with a good sleep plan, it would be a great way to begin your parenthood journey.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the ideal if you were, you know, when you're teaching new parents and you're saying you're going to have a baby soon, let's talk about the sleep issues. Do you recommend laying them down? Like, I remember I was desperate in my last two children. I was like, I am not going through this again. I cannot mm-hmm. function now. And I did do this thing where I'd put them down awake and they fell asleep on their own. Mm-hmm. And it made a massive difference.
Right.
They still had some issues, but mm-hmm. it was way better.
Right.
So I don't know. It was always a collection of things. I was not even in the field back then. It was just, I mean, I had been out of it for a while. I was just kind of figuring it out. But what do you, you know, what's a great thing to tell if we have parents who are listening or are pregnant right now? Maybe they've had babies that didn't sleep well, or they're about to have their first baby. What is sort of the template for them that you recommend?
Consistency, yeah, consistent pre-bedtime routine. Anything that's consistent and predictable is really going to help help the child. Because if the child knows what to expect, then it's much easier for them to kind of get into that routine and accept that routine.
Mm-hmm.
I think the challenge is when you've got a child who has some kind of illness, or when you're not sure that your child has some kind of illness. Now, when I say illness, it could be something minor. It could be constipation. It could be gas. Something mm-hmm. where the child is uncomfortable. As a parent, you don't really know, hey, do I need to comfort my child? My child is a little bit niggly, wiggly. And I think that's where it kind of comes down to instinct, to say, my instinct is telling me this is not normal. My child is, let me check for my child. It's got a fever, or it just doesn't look right.
Mm-hmm.
That's different to, because a lot of times when you have a child who's got this behavioral insomnia and parents are seeking help, they need, and especially if the child has a history of medical problems, they need to be reassured that my child is well enough, because if I'm not going to attend to my child or I'm going to change what I do,
mm-hmm.
I need to be confident that I'm not harming my child.
Of
and
course.
I think that's an absolutely key point, is above all, do no harm.
Right.
And so it's sometimes for parents coming to the point where, hey, I don't have to feel guilty, or I'm not doing any harm. And if I do change my child's behavior, and if we have time, we can talk about how, but that it's not going to harm my child long term, and it's actually in the long term is actually going to be better.
Mm-hmm.
I have a wonderful example of a family where they had terrible time with their child, and long story short is they got him to sleep well, beautifully, and one of the things they had to deal with was, am I going to hurt my child? And to answer your question is, well, when they came for their second time round with their second child, they kind of were, hey, we know what to do this time. We set up the routine, and from the get-go, things were fine. They didn't induce any problems, and this child, mm-hmm. the second child, has been a perfect sleeper.
Right. Yeah, I think that is a big motivator once you've had a child that doesn't sleep. So I can imagine there's so many different reasons. I think when you're a new parent, you're right. I mean, in terms of even feeding issues, you know, you feel like you have to basically, your children have to eat,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you feel like you're having issues with breastfeeding, or they're not liking food, or food allergies, or, you know, all that stuff starts to just combine, and it becomes overwhelming. I think
right.
parents just,
mm-hmm.
and they're so desperate for sleep, they just sort of give up.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. and then, you know, then you're down the road and you're, I can see why it's so much worse. Like you're saying, that makes a lot of sense.
It's just a vicious cycle that you get caught into, you know, as
right.
a parent, because you're just trying to cope. And
right.
so you just keep doing what you've done before.
Absolutely. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the next level, which is more the toddler-ish into preschool. Where do you see issues here and what do they look like?
So for the preschool child, the same concept, we'll talk briefly about this behavioral insomnia of child, is the limit-setting type. This is the child who is making excuses. It's time to go to sleep, Mary. Okay, and Mary's three, and then Mary needs to go say goodnight to the dog. They needs another drink of water. They needs a snack. You know, they needs to come out, get out of bed and ask a question. It's really just delaying things because life is so exciting, and who wants to go to sleep? You know, I'm three. I feel industrious. I want to do things. I want to change the world. And they don't want to go to sleep. And essentially there, it's just a case of the parents are not able to set limits.
Mm-hmm.
And so these children will keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing until the parents get so exasperated, they end up yelling at the kids, and the kids go to sleep then fearful.
Yeah.
And that can set up a whole series of things. And really that just comes down to just setting up standard, you know, good parenting techniques, the same kind of parenting techniques where you set limits for daytime behavior. You just have to set limits for nighttime behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key there is actually learning how to harness where the child is developmentally, because they want to be in control at about three. They feel industrious.
Absolutely.
And so you basically, if you can harness that desire into the strategy, to us saying, for example, okay, so let's have a pre-bedtime routine. So you always want a snack. You want to say goodnight to the dog. So we'll have a little schedule, even a little visual schedule. Child doesn't have to know about time, but let's see what's in the first block. Okay, the first block is say goodnight to the dog. Let's go say goodnight to the dog. Next one, oh, the kitchen's about to close in 10 minutes. This is the last time we have a chance to do a snack. bathroom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we've been through all these usual things that the child is asking for to make excuses to get out of bed. So now that's all done before we get into bed. So you don't have any more excuses because it's all done and checked off and right. et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then what we do is we often use what we call a bedroom pass, where the child you let the child create a little card, take a 3x5 card, let them color it in. And that's a bedroom pass. So they get into bed and they can have the bedroom pass next to them. If they need to get out of bed, they have to hand in the pass. But if they hand in the pass, they do not get a reinforcer like a sticker the next morning. Oh. So, hey, are you sure you want to get out of bed? Because if you get stickers in the morning and you get so many stickers, hey, you get whatever the prize, the desirable prize.
Like so you recommend like a positive reward chart.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So that's pretty easy to do in those kids. Other conditions which occur in young children, which are really can be frightening or disturbing for parents, but really are benign, are things like rhythmic movement disorder. Mm-hmm. That's like where kids are like head banging on the pillow or rocking back and forth, usually just before they fall asleep. And then when they wake up in the middle of the night, they may do that as well. And some kids are pretty violent. They thump the bed, they bang, and if the bed's against the wall, half the house shakes, et cetera, et cetera. And that's frightening because parents are saying, my child's banging their head.
Absolutely.
But it actually is more a sort of sensory-seeking type behavior, and often children that have a lot of sensory-seeking behaviors will have a tendency to do that kind of thing.
Okay.
And it's a form of self-soothing.
Mm-hmm.
The other condition that's fairly common is sleep terrors.
Right.
And those are where the children appear to wake up, and they let out this blood-curdling scream, their eyes are wide open, their heart is racing, they're flushed. And the parent is going to the child and saying, well, what's going on? And the child is not responsive. Child's eyes are open. The child is sitting up, but is not relating to the parent. It seems like they're in another zone. Mm-hmm. And I often use the analogy of the Matrix. Remember the movie The Matrix?
Right, yes.
With you neither night, not living in Zion down in the middle of the earth, and you're not on the earth. You're somewhere in between.
Right.
And in fact, that's kind of what happens, because if we look at the brainwaves of these children doing these events, they are transitioning from a deep stage of sleep to a lighter stage of sleep, and they kind of get stuck.
Okay.
And so physiologically, they're awake, their eyes are open, their heart's going fast, but actually brainwave-wise, they're actually sleeping. So they're kind of in the matrix.
Wow.
And the thing about that is that parents, when they see that, they try and shake the child or wake the child up, and what happens is it agitates them more. Mm. And then the child gets more combative.
Right.
And then what happens is it actually perpetuates it. I had an example of an older child who didn't have a sleep terror, but it was a three-year-old who was having these kinds of sleep terrors. And the mother would try and wake the child up out of this, and the child would become more and more combative. And this would go on, normally these things only last for a few minutes, would go on for about 20 minutes, and then she would end up putting the child in a cold shower.
Oh my gosh.
To get the child to snap out of it. But here's the kicker, because the things that perpetuate these, what we call parasomnias, is often sleep deprivation. So if you're waking the child up out of these events, and they might be happening more than once a night, you're actually sleep depriving the child. So you actually end up perpetuating the condition.
Wow. Yeah, and those are really upsetting to witness, I think, for parents. It really is. I mean, it's a difference between like a nightmare and a crying out and a full-on sleep terror. It's very upsetting and disconcerting for parents. So
yeah, and one of the ways that you can actually tell the difference, you know, is when you're having a nightmare, you remember it, or even a three-year-old, I had a bad dream, right. And the child is awake, the child can converse,
right.
May not be able to tell you the details of the dream, but you know that the child is fully awake, and they're responding to comfort. But a sleep terror, the child is not awake, and if you ask them the next morning, well, do you remember what you did? They have no clue.
Yeah.
It's the same thing for older kids who sleepwalk or sleep talk. It's the same concept. It's the same thing where you're transitioning from deep sleep to light sleep and you're getting stuck. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, they don't have a memory for what actually happened. And another clue that actually is helpful is that these events usually occur in the first half of the night, because that's when you spend most of your time in the deepest sleep, mm-hmm. and that's when you will transition to lighter sleep. You spend the latter part of your night in REM sleep. And then that's usually when you dream throughout the night, but you remember your dreams during REM sleep.
Right.
And so those tend to occur in the early hours of the morning.
Right. So what about kids who cry out? I have a kid who has cried out. I mean, it has a history of medical trauma, pretty significant from like around 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And then it's been crying out and cries out. I mean, it's like this thing never ends. What is that?
Well, again, we've got to figure out, when you say crying out, what are they crying out? Are they still sleeping? So could this be a sleep terror?
Yeah, they're definitely asleep.
They're definitely asleep.
Yeah.
So that would be categorize into what we call the non-REM parasomnia. So this is a situation that's occurring where you're transitioning, you're in non-REM sleep and you're transitioning from a deep stage of non-REM to a lighter stage of non-REM. Mm-hmm. And this is where you're stuck in the matrix.
Okay.
And so a couple of things about these non-REM parasomnias is, okay, sleep deprivation can perpetuate it, but there also is a genetic component. So if there's a family history of sleepwalking, sleep talking, or sleep terrors, there's a much stronger likelihood that the child is going to end up doing the same thing.
Okay.
Other factors that can perpetuate these are environmental stress or psychosocial stresses. They can also trigger these events and perpetuate them.
Okay. Well, I'll have to ask you that after the show. Okay. I have questions for you myself. Okay. All right, guys. Let's talk a little bit about the next level, which is elementary school children. Where do you see challenges with regard to sleep in that population?
So those kids would have sort of parasomnias, the sleepwalking, sleep talking. That seems to be, you know, the common type there. And then the rhythmic movement disorder. I had rhythmic movement disorder. I used to bang my head like crazy.
Oh, did you?
And I remember it was so cool.
Really?
It was so nice. It's because, I mean, and I have sensory issues. I have a lot of sensory seeking behaviors. And so it was very enjoyable to bang my head.
Right.
My parents were just like, what, you know, what?
What are you doing?
What are you doing? Right. And, you know, it was just something and it disappeared. It went away on its own.
When you say sensory seeking behaviors, can you explain that for our audience? What do you mean by that?
Well, there is this concept of sensory processing disorder where children have difficulties making sense, if you like, of sensory information. Mm-hmm. And they have difficulties habituating. For example, think about the child who is getting dressed in the morning and the tags bother them. They can't stand the tags. They have to be cut off. And the sock seams, they're in the way. It doesn't feel right. And the shoes are too tight. The shoes are too loose. Or there's certain fabric on their skin they can't tolerate. So they have difficulty habituating and settling down with that kind of sensation. The same thing can apply with smell. Some kids are very sensitive to smells, and can be nauseating. Or they might be seeking smells. So, you know, they might find a novel object and their first response is to smell it, mm-hmm. because that's kind of how they relate to. Some kids have auditory difficulties. They either are seeking auditory stimuli, and some more commonly have avoidances for auditory stimuli. So they're going into a noisy environment and they want to just hold their ears and close their ears because it's just too much information and I can't make sense of it.
Right.
So sensory processing disorder kind of comes in a sense where you either are sensory seeking, where you're looking for sensation, you're looking for gratification. Sometimes you're looking for things like deep pressure. You're looking for movement, that vestibular movement. It settles you. Mm-hmm. Or you could have these sensory avoidance behaviors. You're in a public restroom and the hand dryer's on and it's just so loud. It's like goes through your whole body.
Right.
And sometimes you can have a combination and your threshold for tolerance can be very reduced. So in kids with these kinds of issues, they are more likely to have these kinds of rhythmic movement disorder because it's a sensor. It's another form of actually deriving sensory input.
Okay, yeah, and that's good to know because I've noticed that a lot of parents struggle with when their children have sensory issues. If there's no serious diagnosis, it's just sort of these little eccentricities they're not extreme, mm-hmm. but they often find them to be behavioral issues. Like you're just mm-hmm. choosing to push back on this issue. And a lot of kids really are very yeah. sensitive to touch and their clothing and to, you know, changes in environment, things like that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's something we need to talk more about.
Yeah.
To be honest.
I mean, that can be perceived as painful or extremely
Absolutely.
Uncomfortable.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, before we continue, what would be the amount of sleep? Let's go through the hours of sleep. So let's go back really quickly. For infants, what's the amount of sleep, average amount of sleep let's get past a newborn, you know, let's say from a year beyond.
So from a year beyond, you're looking at probably around about 12 to 13 hours of sleep.
Okay.
In the preschool, if you're preschool, you're kind of going down by about an hour. If you're elementary school, you're really about 10 hours of sleep.
Okay.
As you approach middle school, it's kind of 9 hours, 8 to 9 hours. Adolescence is very interesting because it's 8 hours initially, but then if we have time, we can talk about it a bit later. is that adolescents kind of tend to move in a little bit more sleep in the middle to late adolescence, and then it, right. then it kind of gets less again as we become adults.
Yeah, I want to talk about that one for sure. Yeah. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else about elementary school age children? What tends to come along? I mean, are we talking about illnesses like we did before? Let's say you have a child who's done a pretty good job. I'm assuming things like trauma, significant change, life stressors. If it just comes out of nowhere, does that happen? Or is it as a child typically have issues that predate something that shows up in the elementary school years?
Usually by elementary school years, sleep issues settle down unless you've not dealt with them. So it's not uncommon for a child who has the behavioral insomnia we spoke about earlier to actually continue mm-hmm. and require. I mean, I have patients of 6, 7 years of age where a parent is still sleeping with them.
Oh, yeah, me too.
You know, or need some kind of support or intervention.
Right.
So if it's not fixed, it's just going to continue. It's the same thing with co-sleeping. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with co-sleeping other than, you know, initially in the first year of life because of the risk of exacerbating sudden infant death syndrome. But, you know, culturally, some cultures right. co-sleep and that's fine.
Right.
But I think at some point when the child is getting to 12 years of age, you may want to make a decision that right. it's time for you to move, buddy.
Right.
You know, and so... The earlier, and there is this misconception, oh, well, the child's going to grow out of it. In fact, some kids will, because now I want to be more independent and I want to, you know, and they might respond more to incentives. Well, you know, you can get a toddler bed now and you can get a car bed. And if you get a car bed, you know, you can sleep and you sleep on your own, you right. can get a car bed and that can work. Those incentives may actually just help break that pattern.
Right.
Some kids have difficulty and they need a little bit of help.
Yeah. Yeah, this gets really complicated. I have a lot of parents who say, well, they start off in their bed and then they end up in my bed, you know, but the kid is a kid who's like fully verbal at like 8, 9 years old telling me the whole story. And I think parents also feel on the one hand, you know, they want to love on their children and they want to be there, but they get frustrated. Mm-hmm. But I think they feel shame about it too, talking about it to other people. Like it's embarrassing, or I don't want to admit that I sleep with my child and my husband's in the other room. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of that too. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get in their room, you're like, okay, let's talk about what's happening. And right. often the child tells you, well, mom's been sleeping with me for the last 5 years
right,
or whatever,
right, yeah.
you know, and daddy snores or mommy snores or whatever.
Yeah.
It's complicated, but I do think
absolutely.
We don't talk about it very much.
I mean, you know, when I work with parents to help change the child's behavior, if they have behavioral insomnia, it's not simple. It's not a cry it out. It's not a, you know, Richard Ferber was the one that first wrote about this and people
the
talk
Ferber
about
method.
Ferberizing.
Right.
You know, it's not that straightforward. You've really got to customize this and you've actually got to go into the parent's mindset as well, because some parents actually don't want the problem to change.
They're
want
enabling the child. The behavior.
It's actually very handy to have a child between the two of them
right.
for other reasons.
Absolutely.
So you've got to get into the parent's mindset as to, well, hey, is this a problem? Do you really want this to change?
Right.
Number one, that's what you've got to get to. And secondly, then, well, what are the obstacles to you as a parent working through and setting up them or getting motivated sufficiently to say, I really need to change this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kinds of insecurities are you projecting onto your child? There's a lot of anxiety. What anxieties do you have? What kind of past history do you have as a parent that you might be projecting? And so those things sometimes have to be dealt with first
right.
before you can even move on to, hey, let's talk about your child and let's see what we can do for your child.
Right.
We need to get the parents out of the way, so to speak.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. But I have so much compassion, right? I know you do too, because it's so they're doing the best they can.
Yeah,
they
sure.
end up there and they don't necessarily have an awareness about
right.
it. And it is hard to change when it's been that way for a long
Absolutely,
time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, let's talk about adolescence, because I think that our children are getting up and going to school way too early mm-hmm. in high school. I don't
Absolutely.
Understand why high school starts earlier than every other school in
Absolutely.
Our district. It's
yeah.
ridiculous. Sorry, Laguna, I love you, but it's ridiculous. Kids mm-hmm. are doing homework until 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
Then they do something on their phone, or they relax, downtime, go to bed. At 6 o'clock, they get up, and they're so cranky, and they're mm-hmm. so tired.
Absolutely.
And their coping skills are very poor.
Yeah.
Right? And they're at risk for substance use. I mean, a lot of kids use Adderall and things like that in mm-hmm. college, just so they can be awake and deal with not sleeping in school.
Right.
So this perpetuates, I think, begins at this time frame
mm-hmm.
in a very unhealthy way. So
yeah.
give me your opinion on that whole situation in terms
yeah.
of what we're doing, how we can fix it.
So welcome to adolescence, one of the most turbulent times in your life. I don't ever want to relive my adolescence, ever.
No.
It's very turbulent. You know, I think it's a time where there's an interaction between physiological changes and also, of course, you know, the psychological changes of becoming a teenager and having this this dichotomy in the sense of am I a child, am I an adult, I'm neither, and some days I want to be an adult, but I don't have the executive skills, or my frontal lobe is still the size of a pea, and I can't be an adult even though I want to. So right. It's a really difficult time for them. Just getting back to the average number of hours a senior has in high school senior has is about 6 hours and 20 minutes. That's the average.
Oh my gosh.
And when you have to get up for zero period and be at school at 6:30 or 7, mm-hmm. And if you have to travel large distances, you have to get up at a ridiculous hour. So some of these, I have patients where they're getting 4 hours of sleep a night.
I believe it. Yep.
They have a long day program. They commute back home. They've got homework to do, and they have zero period. It's crazy. A lot more states, and it was unfortunate because we had the option, at the last elections to actually vote to have later school start times, and it didn't go through, unfortunately. But states like Minnesota, for a number of years now, probably at least 10 years, high schools do not start before 9 o'clock.
I think it's awesome.
And there's very good reason for that. It's not just the fact that the students have a lot of homework, et cetera, but it's also it also ties in with sort of what's happening physiologically.
Right.
And it's a very interesting situation that takes place. And if we have time, I'd be happy to explain what goes on.
We have just a couple minutes on that topic because we're actually going quickly. But I do want you to talk about that because I think it's extremely important.
So when you think about adolescence, there's kind of four things that happen simultaneously. The first one is that there's the phase of adolescent development that they are going through in the physiological phases. And then there's a change in sleep regulation. So very, very briefly about sleep regulation. We all talk about our internal body clock. And we have two systems, we call the homeostatic process, which is two systems, process S and process C, that regulate our body clock. Process C is basically our circadian rhythm with melatonin. When we're exposed to the light, our bodies do not make melatonin. When it gets dark, our bodies produce melatonin. And then you have the process S, which is where you develop sleep pressure. And the analogy is like you're busy working in your kitchen on a very small countertop and you're making a salad and it's starting to get really cluttered and you need to kind of make space. So you sweep all the stuff into a trash can so you make more space. So the analogy is the same as during the day, our brains start to collect molecules which actually contribute to making us sleepy. And those molecules build up and build up and build up and build up until the point where we are so sleepy that we have so much sleep pressure. I'm exhausted. I just have to go to sleep. And the moment you go to sleep, you start to dump. You start to dump all those molecules, but you dump them very quickly. So what happens is your sleep pressure reduces very fast, but when your sleep pressure is down to the bottom where there's hardly any sleep pressure at night, you would then have a propensity to wake up because there's no sleep pressure to keep you asleep. But amazingly, that's when your melatonin levels are at their peak. That help keep you asleep.
Right.
But now that the circadian rhythm system with the melatonin is regulated by what we call Zeitgebers. These are timekeepers. If we didn't have those timekeepers, our day would be 24 hours and say 10 or 15 minutes. And we would have a free running. So you've seen the ads on TV where the person is blind, who's visually impaired, they're day and night. Sometimes they sleep in the day and then they awake at night and then they cycle through. Because they don't have those things, those Zeitgebers that keep your body clock regulated.
Okay.
And those are exposure to light, regular meals, exercise, and socializing. So if you don't have those, then you can't be regulated. Now, the interesting thing about teenagers is their response to those Zeitgebers is sluggish. So that's the physiological component. They actually don't respond as well to those particular signals. The other thing also is that, the sleep pressure that I spoke about that builds up, in adolescence, that the rate of climb of sleep pressure is slower. So then, we think, okay, you're a teenager, you should be tired and you should go to bed at 10:30 because you've got to be up at a ridiculous hour. And they're going to say, well, I'm not tired.
Because I hear it all the
really,
time.
They really are not tired.
Right.
Because their sleep pressure hasn't reached their peak.
Right.
And their body clock is not responding to those time signals and those Zeitgebers as normal. So there's a natural physiological shift for their homeostatic process to move later. So you're saying, well, you've got to go to bed now. It's 10 o'clock. You've done your homework. What's your problem? And the kid lies in bed, not tired.
Right.
What happens then is they start to develop a propensity for what's called psychophysiological insomnia. That's where you start sleep hunting. Mm. You're lying in bed, and we can all relate to this. Mm-hmm. I can't sleep. I can't sleep. I got to go to sleep. and you start to
get more stressed out.
You start to try and sleep hunt.
Right.
And the thing is that sleep is like Peter Pan's shadow. You can't catch it.
Right.
So the more you try, somebody once said, sleep is like a dove. If you reach out your hand, it will gently alight. But if you reach out to grab it, it'll fly away.
Mm.
You cannot try and fall asleep because the very act of trying will cause sleep to evade you.
Right.
Sleep has to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
You can't find it.
Mm-hmm.
So they can actually get into the situation now where they're not tired, but now they're developing a secondary problem where they become anxious because I've got to go to sleep, I've got to go to sleep. And that then activates their mind and then further perpetuates the problem.
Wow.
So that's one of the reasons why teenagers should be allowed to sleep later, because physiologically they will want to go to sleep later. They should be allowed to sleep in and wake up later so they can actually get their 8 hours or in fact their 8.5, in some cases 9 hours of sleep.
Right.
That's bad news for a teenager to hear that. The other two aspects are sleep hygiene. These are the kids that, you know, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Snapchat, I got to update my Instagram, I've got to do this. And they're sitting in bed and they doing all this stuff. And then the thing is that that's activating their mind. And thankfully now we on the screens, we have night mode or sleep mode where, you know, the blue frequency that comes out of these screens actually suppresses melatonin. So now your body's trying to make melatonin, but your electronic media is saying, no, you can't make melatonin because I'm shooting blue wavelength light at you. So the whole sleep hygiene is completely messed up because they're teenagers and they want to do stuff and they want to talk to their friends and FaceTime and, you know, text, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, there's the psychosocial pressure. I'm an adult, you know, I don't go to sleep early. No, that's for kids, you know, it's cool, I'm going to go to bed. I mean, I've heard my teenage patients boast, oh, I had an all-nighter, I'm so cool, you know, I went to bed at 3 a.m., oh my gosh, that was cool, I broke my record. But meanwhile, they can't really function in the day.
You know, they're a nightmare for us the next day.
So it's really kind of juggling, understanding what's happening physiologically, but also there is one has to actually help regulate them in terms of their sleep hygiene, you know, and also help them in terms of the psychosocial pressures, saying, you know, look, electronic media is cool, but okay, I'm sorry, like if you can't control yourself and discipline yourself, give me that phone.
I'm a big fan of taking electronics at night. I mean, for some kids, you don't have to. I think it's just, you have to know your child too.
Yeah, exactly.
Some kids are
some are responsible.
It's just interesting. Absolutely. Yeah. I do think that we need to address that issue for everybody. I think we could talk, frankly, 5 more shows about sleep issues, because I hope you'll come back, because I think that as adults, we have, you know, our own issues with sleep that obviously probably started in childhood. Maybe they didn't. Okay. And so in terms of what happens at a sleep study? Well, I guess my question is, let me back that up. So I'm worried that I heard the show tonight and a bunch of things registered. Maybe I need to have my child evaluated. What does it look like to have an evaluation, and what is a sleep study, and how do you even get a sleep study? My patients are always, you know, I have to make referrals, obviously those types of things, but I think the average person doesn't know how to seek help in that regard.
So Kim, I think, you know, not every sleep problem requires a sleep study, and that's why it's important to do an assessment beforehand, because I mean, I get a lot of referrals from physicians, from different people, even people that are self-referring, saying, I can't sleep, I need a sleep study. A sleep study is actually quite limited in what it can tell you.
Okay.
It can tell you if you have problems with breathing, and I'll go into details in a minute. If you have problems with breathing, let me back up. It can tell you if you're having fragmented sleep. So if something is breaking up your sleep, and that could be breathing issues. It could be that you have movements where you have what we call periodic limb movement disorder, which is associated with commonly with restless leg syndrome. And even convulsions or seizures can fragment sleep. So that's one benefit from doing a sleep study. But you have to go into the history and kind of look at the situation. For instance, if you have a child like with a little toddler who's having problems falling asleep, well, a sleep study is really not going to help you with falling asleep. That's more a behavioral issue. Or if you have anxiety or if you have psychophysiological insomnia, it's not going to help you. But if you have a history where saying, well, you know, my child is snoring, my child is gasping, I've watched my child and they seem to stop breathing. Well, yeah, definitely that would be an indication. Or you might have a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, who you're looking at, and you're saying, well, okay, fine. You know, it's like in medicine, we say not everything that wheezes is asthma. In other words, there are many different causes for wheezing. So for ADHD, there's many different causes. It doesn't have to be the typical ADHD. And so you've got to throw the net wide and actually begin to figure out, well, what are those factors? Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, in some individuals who have ADHD, 50% of them actually have restless leg syndrome. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you don't have to divulge this, but often pregnant women will have a period of having restless leg syndrome where they have this uncomfortable feeling. They just have this urge to move their legs.
Yep.
Just an urge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know a woman who, whenever she drinks caffeine, she has and it's bedtime. And even if it's caffeine in the afternoon, she has restless leg syndrome mm-hmm. symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So 50% of children with ADHD can actually have this RLS condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that is associated with periodic limb movements at night. Now, a periodic limb movement is, the key word is periodic. So, you know, we all kick and we fuss and we roll over at night. But periodic is periodic. It's a series of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 limb movements within usually about a 90-second time frame, and it has to meet certain criteria. But often with those limb movements, you arouse. Your brain wakes up for 1, 2, 3 seconds. So if you're doing that throughout the night, your sleep's going to be very fragmented, and
right.
then you're not going to be sleeping well.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be refreshed, so your ADHD is going to be worse. So sometimes getting a history on the back end saying, well, my child is not sleeping well or functioning well, we've got to go back, and often we can ferret out other conditions.
Okay. So a good evaluation is obviously very important.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, so what percentage would you say of patients that you actually see actually would need a sleep study, just to put it in real terms?
Okay. So let's look at it this way. So the most common reason for doing a sleep study is if you're having sleep apnea.
Okay.
And that in children is somewhere around 3-4% of kids. So it's not that much.
Right.
But that's really what we are mainly doing sleep studies for. And again, if you're suspecting other things
narcolepsy,
that are fragmenting your sleep.
Now,
narcolepsy is a completely different story. The incidence of that is about 1-2%. And in fact, in children, the most common presentation of narcolepsy in children is academic failure.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, most of my patients that have presented with narcolepsy, who have narcolepsy, have presented with school failure.
Interesting.
And it's so wonderful to see once you identify the problem and you treat them, you watch their grades move from an F to an A. It's very, very rewarding.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's such a good point. You know, it's not like it's a clear A to B type of situation. You really have to start looking at all the factors that
mm-hmm.
contribute. And then thinking about something like sleep is so vital, it would actually affect your performance. It makes perfect sense. We just don't think of it that way. Okay. Just tell our listeners how they can find you, any information you want to share about yourself and your practice, please.
Sure. So I've been doing pediatric sleep medicine for over 16 years now, and I now have an office in Aliso Viejo, just near the Target, off Osa Parkway,
mm-hmm.
and so I do consults there, sleep consults, and I also do behavioral consults because the overlap between behavioral problems and sleep problems is there's just so much overlap.
Right.
I also have a sleep lab at the same facility, so in the day it's a really nice place. The rooms look like consulting rooms in the day, and we switch them over to beautiful bedrooms at night.
Wonderful.
So happy to see. And also we do adults as well. I have a physician who sees adults exclusively, because it's really very hard to treat the whole spectrum as one person. So we're able to assess the full gamut of sleep problems from 0 to 100.
Great. And tell us your website and any other information, email, phone numbers, mm-hmm. things like
sure.
that.
Sure. So the website is oceansleepmedicine.com.
Okay.
And the telephone number is 949-446-8990. And we're on Yelp. Just Google us and you'll find us. Yeah.
Great. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Feldman. I really appreciate you joining me tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was very informative. I feel like there's so many. We could have spent an hour on each topic because mm-hmm. I think that it is such a complicated and interesting issue to address. So thank you so much.
Sure.
You've been listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage, and our show explores our moods, our minds, and our real lives every Monday evening at 8 p.m. I switch. I used to be at 8 a.m. on Sundays. My brain's still there. And please have a wonderful evening and get some good sleep yourselves tonight, you guys. And I'll look forward to seeing you next week. Take care.